This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The federal government remains shut down. Well, kind of. The Democratic House Committee chairmen are getting their invitations to testify, ready to go to the printer. Democratic candidates for president are making appearances on friendly talk shows and booking flights to Iowa. It is a busy time in politics, and here to make sense of it all, or help us make sense of it all, is our friend Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Ken, welcome to All Sides.
Mike, you expect me to make sense of it all?
Try. We're going to try.
Okay.
At least for the next hour.
All right.
We'll give people points to ponder anyway. Well, Ken, thanks very much for joining us here today on this gray.
Thanks,
I don't know what the weather is like in Washington, but it's a gray January day here in Columbus.
Even the weather is shut down here.
Yes, it
There's
is.
No weather.
Does the shutdown affect the NOAA? I don't know. Does it affect NOAA? The Weather Service?
Well, all I know is that there were absolutely no cars on the road during the snowstorm and during the shutdown. It's delightful if you have to be on the road, but of course, nobody likes to drive in the snow. Washington doesn't know how to drive in snow, so it's kind of fun to watch people learning how to brake and learning how to turn when there's snow everywhere.
Indeed. Let's talk shutdowns here. I want to step back. We'll talk about the politics in a moment, but I want you to, you've lived through a few of these, and you've been in D.C. for all of these, I would assume. And of course, D.C. is affected more than any other part of the country by federal government shutdowns. How do you compare this shutdown now in its 27th day? How do you compare it to past shutdowns?
No comparison whatsoever. Not only because of the length, but because of the first of all, I mean, a lot of it is political posturing, and of course, and sometimes you shut down the government at a peak. When you think of what the Republicans did in 2013 because they didn't want to fund Obamacare, so Ted Cruz decided that he wanted to shut down the government. They shut down the government for 13 days. It seemed to be backfiring against the Republicans, but the next year, the Republicans won control of the Senate, picked up seats in the House, so you can make the case, well, there really wasn't much of a political impact. But it didn't seem to be the kind of thing that's happening now with people really questioning whether they want to leave their jobs, whether they have to get second jobs. There are so many contractors who work for the government who will not get back pay when and if this ever ends. So they are out as long as, like, for 27 days. They are losing 27 days of pay. They're not getting any of it back. And it's, I think, given the ridiculous reasons for why this government is shut down, the cost is far greater than I think anybody, including the president and the Republicans in Congress, imagined.
But honestly, here in Ohio, Ken Rudin, a political junkie, Ken Rudin, we're not seeing the impact. Some people are, no doubt. I was at the airport a couple of weeks ago, and I had the greatest admiration for the TSA agents there who were doing their job just like it was any other day, and they knew they weren't going to get paid right away. And there are federal workers, I think around 6,000 or so in Ohio, that are working without pay or furloughed. But it's one of the things I think is the reason why it's lasted 27 days is it's really not affecting folks outside of D.C. like other shutdowns. National parks were open for business over the Christmas holiday season. Social Security, they're not checks anymore. They're deposits. They're getting made. Passports are being processed because that's a fee involved, so it's not affected by the shutdown. Our tax refunds are going to get processed because they're, quote, essential workers at the IRS. Is this shutdown not tough enough for the average American who does not work for the federal government?
Well, that's a great question. It's not only a political question, but it's an economic question at all. And I think, you know, if there were more people who, for example, there's not many more people calling in sick than there usually is during a shutdown. If more people decided to say, wait a second, this is really killing me financially, I can't afford to work for free, like the people at the TSA, for example, then I think people around the country would feel it. But I agree with you. Look, there are people on the border. There are people at different government agencies. It's not a complete government shutdown. And the fact that President Trump is deciding to bring in certain more and more workers are suddenly becoming more and more essential. So he's bringing them back to work. Of course, without pay. But if that's the case, it almost lessens the impact, the economic impact of a shutdown, but at the same time, it also lessens the desire or the urgency to come up with a solution if the economic costs are not as great.
Can Donald Trump give in and say, let's reopen the government without an agreement to build his wall, or the wall? I shouldn't say it's his wall. The wall.
Can he or will he?
Yeah.
Can he or will he?
Yeah.
No, he won't. He won't do that because, I mean, this is the basis of his candidacy from the moment he announced his campaign, when he took down that escalator ride down Trump Tower in 2015. Not only were Mexicans sending us, you know, rapists and drug users and murderers and things like that, also some good people, but at the same time, he promised a wall. He said from the beginning that he's going to build this wall. That's what helped get him elected in 2016. Of course, at the back then, Mexico was going to pay for it. He never said that the Americans were going to pay for it. And I think if he insisted that Congress pays $5.7 billion for the wall, it may not have been the same result in November of 2016. But this has been the basis of his candidacy from day one. It's what his base relies on. And given the fact that his numbers, if you look at any of the recent polls, his numbers are anywhere between maybe 37 and 41% approval, which is pretty low for a president. It's not historically low, but it's pretty low. He only has that base to rely on. And giving in on the wall would be a big betrayal. I mean, we saw the Senate not too long ago vote unanimously to, okay, let's hold off on the shutdown and let's negotiate. And Trump was fine with that. The Senate voted like 100, you know, it was a voice vote, but it was unanimous. And then when Ann Coulter and other conservatives said, wait a second, you're selling out the base, he immediately switched gears and say, nope, I'm shutting down the government. I'm not going to reopen it. So can he and will he are two different things.
We're talking with Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. It's our monthly look at politics with Ken. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at WOSU.org, or you can reach us on Twitter, and that is at WOSU All Sides. Ken, is there any sign? I saw a poll or a news of a poll in the last 24 hours that even the base is starting to lose patience with the whole shutdown. Is there any evidence of that, or is that 34% still solidly with him?
Well, I mean, I have not seen signs that his base has deserted him, certainly, but I have seen individual anecdotes, and there were always those kind of anecdotes where people, you know, you always say that, you know, like in states where that are very, very conservative, but there's a lot of poverty in some of these states, like Kentucky, for example, or West Virginia, and yet they continue to vote Republican, even though perhaps some of the Republican policies may not be as good for the lower incomes, but, you know, they stay with it because of politics. So I haven't seen, I think what's going to change, if it changes, is one, more and more people will be calling in sick. But more importantly, I'm watching what the Republicans in the Senate do, because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has made it clear that he's staying out of it, not because he's not interested. He keeps saying that, look, this is between President Trump and the Democrats in Congress. The reason McConnell is staying out is because he doesn't know what Trump wants. Matter of fact, he probably feels that the real debate going on in Washington is Trump versus Trump. And the reason is because the president has set down different markers at different times during the shutdown that change from day to day. So even when Lindsey Graham, the Republican, said, okay, let's temporarily open the government again, and let's negotiate, Trump said, absolutely not. I'm not doing anything until I get the money for the wall. So I think Mitch McConnell has no choice but to say, I'm staying out of it because I don't know what the president wants.
Democrats are being equally as stubborn. They're saying no wall whatsoever. Can they give in at this point?
No, they probably have the same problem with their base. I mean, when there was some talk, I mean the Democrats tried it last year when there was a mini shutdown, I guess last January. Seems like there's a shutdown all the time now. But there was a mini shutdown in January of 2018. And, you know, Trump calls it the Schumer shutdown, but it was a Schumer shutdown. he decided to shut down the government for a couple of days because there was no money for the DACA program, no money for the Dreamers who want to be here and not be deported. People here brought illegally as children, and they don't want to be deported. So Schumer kind of shut the government down, and when he gave in, he said, okay, it's not working anyway. When he gave in, he got a lot of heck from his base. So he's not going to do it again. Plus the fact that the president has said things in the past that he's backed off on. He said that he wants to work on it. And yes, we could blame the Democrats for being intransigent and all that stuff. But remember that time in the White House not that long ago between, among Lion Chuck Schumer, crying Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, the president, and silent Mike Pence, they were sitting there and the Trump said, look, I'm going to shut down the government. I'll take the blame for it. I'll take the credit for it. It's not going to be on you. It'll be on me. So, I mean, basically the president gave the Democrats an out, but are the Democrats being stubborn? I think if you're non-political, you can say both sides need to come to an agreement. But I think the Democrats feel they have a political ace in the hole, and they're certainly using it.
At least until the security lines at the Newark Airport and LaGuardia and JFK and Dulles start to get really long.
Not then. Until the polls say that that both sides are being equally blamed right now, that they blame Trump and the Republicans.
Yeah. Speaking of compromises, Rob Portman, our senator here in Ohio, also Senator John Thune, they've floated this out before. I think Lindsey Graham has actually floated this plan out in the past. It hasn't gone anywhere, but their plan is a compromise, $25 billion over 5 years in border security, which would include what Portman says is fencing, and it would include a permanent fix to DACA, providing permanent legal status to immigrant children brought here illegally into the U.S. by their parents. Is this a way out? Is this compromise possibly a way for both sides to say, look, we've hit a compromise here. We got the government back and we both sides got something out of it.
I think once upon a time, the Democrats were talking about that as well. They were saying that, oh, we'll trade you the wall for the Dreamers. But the president has said in recent days that I'm not going to do anything about the Dreamers until the Supreme Court acts on the legality of the program at all. So once upon a time, the Dreamers were part of that calculation. It seems like it's less and less possible because even the president says, I'm not going to make that kind of trade because it may not even be legal.
State of the Union address is on hold or in doubt. It's a week and a half, 2 weeks away. That'd be kind of extraordinary if they had to cancel the State of the Union address. It would be inappropriate, wouldn't you think, to have it during a government shutdown?
Inappropriate to have it? Well, the thing is, I don't know if Nancy Pelosi overplayed her hand or not. I'm not sure that was the right thing to do because then the Republicans say, oh, the Democrats are trying to silence the president. Look, Nancy Pelosi knows and the Democrats know that this is the president's finest hour in his own mind, that he gives his address that everybody is watching, everybody in Congress is watching. But we also saw what the president did during his 9-minute address from the Oval Office. Yeah, Oval Office. Did you say awful office?
No, Oval. It's Oval.
Oh, I'm sorry. and basically he said absolutely nothing new. So I kind of think that, look, the president, I mean, we've seen cancellations before. Of course, Ronald Reagan canceled his 1986 State of the Union address because of the Challenger tragedy. But so it's happened before. But for Pelosi to say, well, security is the reason, I don't think we should have this. I'm not sure that I think it may have given Trump a little argument on his behalf that the Democrats are afraid of him. But
you know what's going to happen.
Anyway.
You know what's going to happen, Ken. He's going to have his own speech. He's going to be at a rally on January 29th, and he's going to give his State of the Union address, and it's going to be a speech in front of all of his supporters. So he's not going to miss the opportunity.
No, of course. Guarantee he can either give it from the White House, or he can give it from the – he can go down to the border wall and give his speech for the State of the Union. I mean, that's the president's prerogative, but – again, I just think that, is it inappropriate to have it during a shutdown? Well, let the president make the argument why there's a shutdown. But right now, most polls show 53-55% of the American public say that he's at fault. But even though more and more people, not a majority, but more and more people are saying that they see the wall is a legitimate reason, is a legitimate response to a border crisis. Whether it's a crisis or not is something else, but more and more people are agreeing with Trump on that.
All right, our guest, Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Just a point of clarification, apparently the National Weather Service is operating. It's good news with a storm approaching, a snowstorm approaching, but you can't tour their facilities, Ken. That's shut down. So I know that was high on your list.
I know former Senator Olympia Snow was very concerned about that.
Yes.
That's a silly joke. I can't believe it's better than myself.
You know, wintry mix. Anyway, we'll be back with Ken Rudin. And we'll also talk about the officially growing field of Democrats looking to run against Donald Trump in 2020 when All Sides continues here on 897 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're just a few weeks into 2019, and already the Democratic field for president is getting crowded. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand announced her exploratory committee for president this week. Former Housing and Urban Development Director Julian Castro announced his bid for president the other day. Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio announced he's doing a tour through early primary states. He's calling it the Dignity of Work Tour. Here's Brown on NPR, not officially announcing he's running for president.
I want to at least inform the national conversation. I want whoever is the nominee to talk about the dignity of work. That's why we're doing this tour. And we will figure it out in March if I want to make this run.
Political junkie Ken Rudin, host of the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, joins us, or remains with us. Ken, what do you think of this field so far? Any surprises? Not really, I would guess.
Well, there are some surprises. I mean, the thing is, you're seeing more colors, more women than you've ever seen before, and I think it's good. I mean, I think the fact is, you know, we were joking or not joking about the 2016 Republican field that they couldn't all fit on the same stage during a debate. You needed two different days. I think you may need 3 days for the Democrats. We're talking about anywhere between 20 and 30 candidates. I don't know how serious they all are. And you mentioned a bunch of them. Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman, the progressive pro Bernie Sanders congresswoman from Hawaii, announced over the weekend as well. So you have a lot of people. You have the Kamala Harris's. You have, and we don't know what Joe Biden's going to do. We don't know what Beto O'Rourke is going to do. It's exciting. It may be hard to get your voice out there, but I guess everybody, you know, I mean, everybody has a case to make, and it'll be interesting to see what they do, if they eat each other alive or they make it civil, or we'll see what happens.
You know, in 2016, the phrase came into vogue, the lane. He's got the Christian right lane, speaking of the GOP candidates for president. He's got the moderate lane. He's got, you know, there are all these lanes. Do you see similar lanes developing in the Democratic race, and are there lanes?
I don't, because the party has certainly moved more to the left than it has been in previous, certainly more to the left than what Hillary Clinton was promising in 2016. And so there are, look, a lot of it is about personality. A lot of it is about, it's not about voting record, because I think Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders and Kirsten Gillibrand, I think they all basically vote the same. There may be some differences, like Joe Biden may be less reflexive on the left than, let's say, a Tulsi Gabbard or a Bernie Sanders. But no, that's a good question. I don't think there's somebody who is the woman candidate, the progressive candidate. I think they all share a lot of qualities that intertwine with each other. And a lot of it may be decided on personality or how much money they can raise.
Yeah. Also, who can win? I mean, you have to win back those sort of, the old term was a Reagan Democrat. Now, I guess you could call him a Trump Democrat, independents who voted for Barack Obama, but then went and voted for Donald Trump in 2016. You have to, that could come down to that. Who can win the coasts and who can win the Rust Belt folks like in Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin?
Well, that's a great question. That's perhaps part of Sherrod Brown's appeal or potential appeal. But, I mean, is the party going to pick a Kirsten Gillibrand or a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker who are, you know, from the two coasts that are very liberal, but will they appeal to the Ohio, Wisconsin's, Michigan's, and Iowa's, things like that? So maybe that's what Sherrod Brown brings to the ticket. So we'll see what happens. But right now, everybody has to figure out what they bring and why they are different and why they deserve to be heard in Iowa, New Hampshire, and then elsewhere.
And let's be honest, you need someone with a personality who can match Donald Trump, no matter what their position is.
Well, I don't know if you want to imagine Donald Trump, but certainly you need to have a pulse. And but look, I don't think Bernie Sanders was Mr. Personality in 2016, but he represented something that many Democrats felt was missing, that the passion of his views. I mean, you know, he was not a smiling kind of guy. He was not a laugh riot kind of guy.
No, but he had,
but
that,
I guess it was not,
he had that passion. I guess that's what I'm saying. You need to have the passion to match Donald Trump. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because I watched Kirsten Gillibrand on Colbert the other night, and I saw some clips of her the next day campaigning upstate New York, and it seemed a little pablum to me. It's early, and people need to get their acts together, but it just seemed like she was doing basic banalities of, well, you know, we need to bring people together. And, I mean, look, it's early, and we still have 13 months to go before the Iowa caucuses. But actually, 13 months to go is not a long time. You know, it's coming up very quickly. And obviously, you need to hire staff. You need to raise money. You have to have a field organization in Iowa. And, look, you could lose Iowa and still win the nomination. I mean, obviously, and that's happened many times. Bill Clinton, for example, didn't win Iowa or New Hampshire, and he became the nominee. So, but you don't want to get wiped out early. Joe Biden and Chris Dodd were two senators who had great qualifications, but on the night of the 2008 caucuses, when they were running against Obama and Clinton, Hillary Clinton, they dropped out that night because, you know, all they can get is like 1%. So a victory isn't essential, but getting wiped out early could be a death knell sooner than they expected.
We're speaking with Ken Rudin, host of the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. He's a veteran political journalist with NPR and ABC before that. We're talking politics here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Even before the votes are cast the caucus in Iowa, with so many candidates, I'm thinking you have to get in early and get a message that resonates, because there will be many people in this race, and it can only fit so many people on a stage in a debate. And the way the GOP and the networks did it in 2016 was you had to be in the top tier in polling. So for someone like Sherrod Brown, the longer he waits, and if he's not getting traction, he's not going to creep up in the polls to get in that top 10 or 12 candidates who are going to be on that stage. Am I wrong there?
You're absolutely right, and especially right because the debates, it's my understanding the debates are going to start as early as this June. So you can't wait for May or June to get into the race and then suddenly wait for your numbers to build if the June criteria is polling numbers. So I think the next couple of weeks, are going to be very, very busy, very, very crowded, very, very exciting. And again, does Joe Biden need to announce right away? Does Beto O'Rourke need to announce right away? I don't think they do. But at some point, you know, I think they need to send a signal to people out there that they're very serious about a possible race. I don't know what Joe Biden is thinking. I know a lot of people have great affection for him. I know there's an age question, but, you know, Donald Trump is 72. So that's out there as well. But look, you know, I mean, he was a popular vice president. I mean, he failed miserably in his two times running for president in 1987 and again in 2008. But it's a new Joe, it's a different Joe Biden, and everybody has this affection for him. Let's see if it translates to a much younger, an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez kind of Democratic Party.
What about Elizabeth Warren? There's a lot of controversy. Is she likable or not? That brought up all kinds of charges of sexism and things like that. But she's in. She hasn't formally announced, but she is definitely running. She went to Iowa and got good crowds.
Got right.
Something.
I was unhappy with that likable debate or not, because I mean, yes, it sounds like it reeks of sexism. But at the same time, we used to say about Ted Cruz, is he likable enough? Nobody ever said Ted Cruz was likable.
No.
But he still, did fairly well. But I don't like when they say, well, she's too aggressive, or she's too, she scolds people. I mean, there are certain code words out there that seem to be reserved for female candidates that you would never use on men, and that's disappointing.
Shrill is another word. Yeah.
Shrill, absolutely. But she has Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard as well. I mentioned her only because she seemed to have announced last weekend. But they are on the I would say, either left-wing or progressive, depending on your point of view, progressive fringes. Not even fringes, because they're not certainly not fringe candidates. But there's certainly a point of view that is different than the Democratic Party has seen before. Like Obama was pretty... I mean, Obama was certainly perhaps to the left of Hillary Clinton, but he was not, he was not a radical or anything like that. There are still some people who feel that Warren and Bernie Sanders may be too far to the left to win nationwide. But at the same time, there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who feel this is exactly what the country needs to turn back the corporate control of politics from both parties, and especially what Trump has done to the political discourse.
Getting back to Sherrod Brown, he's very good on his talking points. This dignity of work, every soundbite he talks about work, and he's got his talking points down. Is whether you earn a wage, whether you earn tips, whether you're working in a factory, whether you're caring for an elderly parent. It's a strong message, and he's disciplined on it. Will it work?
Who knows? I mean, who knows? Did anybody see Obama, Barack Obama, coming from nowhere in 2008 and winning the nomination? The fact that what Brown, I'm looking at all these, the list of candidates, and there are very few people from, the heartland, the so-called heartland of the country. Sherrod Brown has that. And while that blue wave that took over much of the country in 2018, it didn't happen in Ohio. You had Mike DeWine winning. You had all the Republican members of Congress get reelected in Ohio. But you had Sherrod Brown winning big. So he can make the argument that he won big in a Trump state. Trump won the state by 8 percentage points. I think Sherrod Brown may have won by the same amount.
Yeah, about 7,
and,
yeah.
And I guess if the Democrats are going to win the White House, they have to look at, as they say, those states that Obama won, but Trump won as well. And that's certainly, you lead with Ohio in that list.
Speaking of Ohio, do we still have the same poll as we did? You talked about how the GOP swept every race just about except for Sherrod Brown's race.
Yeah. I mean, that's something to be said about him. Of course, there was not, I don't think it was the greatest Republican field. I mean, Jim Renacci,
Northeast Ohio.
Yeah, there was some dispute about who was going to be the nominee. The first candidate dropped out.
Josh
Renacci
Mandel
got in. Yep. Josh Mandel, right. And Renacci, look, is solid conservative, but I think maybe a better candidate. I mean, I always thought that Rob Portman would be a great Senate candidate. What am I saying? Rob Portman, he's a Senate candidate.
You can't hold two seats at once.
Yeah, exactly. I'm saying that more, maybe somebody who may have had more appeal among more independents might have been a stronger candidate. But the point is, I'm not taking away from Sherrod Brown. He won it. He won big, and he won it in a state that Republicans seem to be winning everywhere else.
Yeah, a lot of Republicans, because Jim Renacci really didn't spend any money on his campaign, didn't do a whole lot of traditional campaigning, didn't do any TV ads, so to speak. They're like, what if? What if he had spent some of his money and run a few more ads? And it could have been tighter. Who knows? But it was a... It, it definitely is a launching pad for Sherrod Brown. Do you think he gets in? I mean, he's doing this tour. He's going to Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. I forget where else.
You know, he was my prediction for Hillary Clinton's vice president, running mate in 2016. I thought that he would have been far more than Tim Kaine. I thought he could have given him the ticket on Ohio and perhaps more of a sense of the Midwest. It would have, you know, I mean, you think of all the mistakes that Hillary Clinton made, didn't go to Wisconsin, made a few stops in central Pennsylvania, blah, blah, blah. I think Sherrod Brown could have helped the ticket. I always saw a higher office for him, but this is a, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what has he got to lose? He wouldn't give up his Senate seat or anything like that. And he could test the waters and you know, run for a while. I mean, look, Elizabeth Dole, Dan Quayle, people like that ran briefly. What's his name? The former Tim Pawlenty was out of the race before Iowa. So in other words, they could get in and then see maybe by the fall, if they're not raising money, if they're not making a difference, they could drop out. But I don't think he has anything to lose, especially with that geographical advantage I think he has.
Yeah, and he's in his very first months of his new term, so he doesn't face the voters again for 6 years.
Right.
There is some talk that, you know, if he would have been the vice presidential or presidential candidate and win, then a Republican governor would maybe be able to name his replacement. But that, to me, that's too far down the road.
Oh, you know,
and it's a fair trade.
That is so, I see that all the time. I said, well, you know, the bad thing about Sherrod Brown being elected president is that, and defeating Donald Trump, is that Mike DeWine would appoint his successor in the Senate. That's what the Democrats are afraid of. I mean, that's crazy. So,
yeah, I think
most Democrats will take that trade any day of the week.
Yeah, any day. We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. He hosts the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. You can find it wherever you get your podcast and on the WOSU Public Media mobile app. If you don't have that yet, check it out. We'll continue our discussion about the 2020 race. We'll also look at John Kasich's new career when we continue on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are joined by Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of the podcast Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. John Kasich has found a new job.
Former Ohio Governor John Kasich, CNN's newest senior political commentator, joins me now. Welcome to the team.
Yeah,
we are benefited by your presence.
Just so we can deal with the elephant in the room, people want to know, what's he doing? Look, as you know, Chris, I've had many years of experience. It's my job to try to explain things to people. And I'm not going to explain them from any particular perspective, just what I think. I'm going to be like an umpire calling balls and strikes. And that's what
Kasich this week appeared on CNN. He's done that, before, of course, but this time he is getting paid, we assume, as the new senior political commentator for the network. Ours, even though he said in that introduction that he's not on CNN to promote himself, hours after he made that appearance, his political organization sent out a fundraising email with a picture of him on CNN. Ken Rudin, what is John Kasich up to?
Well, first of all, look, he did sweep Ohio in the 2016 primaries. That's the only state he won. And he does feel that he's a viable alternative to Donald Trump in 2020 in the Republican primaries and caucuses. It's interesting that if even in that little sound clip you played of John Kasich, he said the word I and me and my, like, you know, five times in every sentence. I am not. I am. I'm a straight shooter. I'm independent on this or this. The fact is that I think what he has to say is very valuable. I think he can be very, very candid. I think I know a lot of people from Ohio who said they can't believe this guy's an independent when he can be very, very partisan and angry at times. But there's a new John Kasich, I think, at least since 2016. So do I think he's running? I do. Do I think CNN knows what they got when they hired him? Sure they do. Do I think he's going to have to announce fairly soon if he's going to be a factor? I don't know about fairly soon, but obviously he can't be a candidate and work for CNN at the same time. I mean, Pat Buchanan had that problem with the networks as well. So, you know, this is about John Kasich. It's about his campaign. I think he has a lot to offer. I think Republican criticism of Trump, which is not rare to find on networks these days, but it comes, I think it's good to hear it from John Kasich. But at some point, if he's going to run, he's going to have to figure out what he wants to do sooner than later. Mm-hmm. I just don't see, whatever you think about Donald Trump and the national polls, he is still extremely popular in the Republican Party. And, maybe one-on-one would be interesting, but Jeff Flake is thinking about running on the Republican side, maybe Ben Sasse of Nebraska. So
it all comes I think it all comes down to what Bob Mueller finds. And if it's really bad, and if Trump is severely damaged, or if Trump decides he's not going to run again, then all bets are off. But I think it all comes down to that. I think that's, otherwise, there's maybe no way you're going to beat him in a Republican primary.
But you know something, even if Mueller comes out and say, yes, he did shoot somebody on the middle of Fifth Avenue with that famous quote by Donald Trump, I don't know how far the base will desert him. I don't know. I just see it. To me, there are so many instances over the past 2 years where, okay, this time he went too far. Okay, this time what he said, he went too far. And yet, no discernible difference in the polls. He still has the same support within the party, and it's pretty large. You know, if he endorses somebody in the primary, they often win. We saw that with Kris Kobach in Iowa, in Kansas. I mean, when he won the Republican primary. So he's very influential in the Republican Party. Trump is, and I don't know whatever. I don't know if something even Robert Mueller comes up with will damage him that much. I mean, it may force him out of office, but I'm not convinced the Republican base will desert him. Speaking of the Republican base, can I just switch subjects for one quick second?
Because sure.
This fascinated me. What happened to Steve King?
Yes, that was on my list. Yes.
Oh, good. Because he's the congressman from Northwest Iowa who has been saying racially insensitive things for years. I mean, about immigrants, about people of color. He's friended neo-Nazi figures in Europe. I mean, he's really out there.
And his latest quote, which I think gets lost in this controversy, but his latest quote, he was in an interview with the New York Times. He said, quote,
right,
white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? That's the quote that has got him in trouble.
Right, exactly. And as opposed to everything else he's always said.
But it's the latest thing, yes.
But somehow the Republican Party in the House feels he just went too far. He crossed the line. So Kevin McCarthy, the Republican minority leader in the House, stripped him of all his committees, which includes agriculture, which is going to be a tough sell when you go back to campaign in Iowa. I am no longer on the agriculture committee. Please reelect me. So, and everybody said this is abhorrent. This is intolerable. Believe it or not, there was a debate on the House floor on Tuesday about denouncing white racism. I can't believe that in 2019 we need to have a resolution whether to denounce white racism, but we did, and the vote was 424-1, and everybody's happy about that.
Now, can Republicans have come down a little bit on Steve King? You know, took away his committee chairmanships, committee positions, as you said. But, you know, Democrats run the House now, but there is not a vote to censure him. They haven't been willing to take that step.
Yeah, no, I'm surprised at that. I don't know if they want to make him a martyr or not. I don't know why that hasn't happened. I know some Democrats are not, like Bobby Rush, the one Democrat who voted against the resolution because he said it wasn't strong enough. He hasn't given up his idea about censure, but I don't know. I mean, you know, they've censured other members of Congress for saying indefensible things, and I don't. And yet the same Republicans who roll their eyes or shrug their shoulders when Donald Trump will say something insensitive about Muslims, about women, about Latinos, and yet they're so, wow, this Steve King thing, this is a line too far. It just seems like, wow.
I've seen the theory, it's a theory, that Steve King has become sort of the surrogate for Donald Trump, and Republicans can beat up on Steve King for saying racist things because they can't beat up on Donald Trump for fear of alienating his base. Do you think there's any merit in that theory?
Well, in defense of some Republicans, they'll say, look, you know, like Mitch McConnell says, I've given up worrying about what the president tweets, and I've stopped commenting on that. But I really care about the language in our body, in Congress. So some Republicans are saying the excuse is, well, you know, he's part of our it's part of our job description, not the president. And so, but you're right. I mean the vehement denunciations of Steve King by Republicans in the past week or so just seems to like, well, where were you when Donald Trump says these things? It's pretty remarkable.
Interesting. Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, is our guest here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The Mueller investigation, we assume, is chugging along. No word officially from Mueller's team, but, bits of news leak out. This weekend, the Washington Post and New York Times found or reported that the FBI was investigating whether Donald Trump was actually a foreign agent in the final months of the 2016 campaign. That was an extraordinary story.
I woke up Thursday morning and looked at the front page of the New York Times saying, you know, FBI investigating whether Trump is an agent of Russia. I mean, the fact that that is even a possibility. And of course, we've talked about for the longest time that he never criticized Putin. He wants to get out of NATO, which is Trump said he's talking about leaving NATO, which would be great for Putin. He'll take Putin's word over his own American intelligence agencies. I mean, we know about that for the last 2 years, but the fact that you see the headlines investigating him as a possible Russian agent. I mean, I remember in the 1950s, the John Birch Society used to talk about Dwight D. Eisenhower was a dedicated conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. Robert Welch, the head of the John Birch Society, talked about that. But, you know, it's the John Birch Society. That's part of their paranoia. But when the FBI really questions whether the president might be working on behalf of Russia's interests, my goodness, I mean...
Does that story... I wonder if that story actually... Because... those previous examples you mentioned where it was paranoia that fed those those theories.
Right.
Here it is here again, but it's not considered paranoia. But Trump can say, look, come on now. I'm not an agent of the Russian government. I may want to change in policy, but I'm not a spy. It seemed like it's almost like crossed a different line this time. And he can use that to his advantage. The president can't.
Well, I mean, look, he said no to everything that, you know, he said, I did not pay off these women. And said, we find out he did pay off these women. I did not, do X, Y, or Z. And we find out he did do X, Y, or Z. So I don't know. I mean, that's why we are waiting the Mueller investigation and the report. I don't know how much William Barr, the likely new attorney general, will allow to reach the public. But I suspect that. I suspect that one of the reasons Rod Rosenstein announced his decision that he's going to be leaving his job soon made me think that Mueller, some kind of a conclusion may be coming sooner than later. I mean, I have no idea, but I can't imagine Rosenstein saying he would leave if that weren't the case. And I'm sure the president is bracing for it. I'm sure we're bracing for what Michael Cohen will say to the House committee when he testifies next month about all the things the president did. And my goodness, it's
hard to keep up.
Well, it's hard to keep up, and you know that the president, I mean, every time he's being hammered about the shutdown and the wall and things like that, you know that has to be weighing on him as well. Boy, I think it's tough being, I don't think anybody has sympathy for it, but it's tough being Donald Trump these days, I would say.
Ken Rudin, host of the political podcast, Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, is our guest here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. You know, Rudy Giuliani hadn't put his foot in his mouth in quite some time, at least 10 or 12 days. And last night he said that, onto CNN, that people in the Trump campaign may have colluded with Russia, but the president did not. I thought that was pretty extraordinary. Whether it was intentional or not, I don't know. It was one of those smack-your-head moments.
I think we should smack Rudy's head, but I think he does these things. I don't know if it's Rudy being Rudy, which it may be, mm-hmm. But sometimes I think the things he says hurt Trump's cause more than anything else. I saw that, and of course, everybody came up with other instances where Giuliani said, absolutely, there was no collusion, no collusion. So
should we read anything into it? Is it, you know, now, you know, the Trump campaign is willing to implicate some folks in the Trump orbit is willing to implicate some folks in the campaign as sort of sacrificial lambs, or is it just Rudy being Rudy? And
I think it's the latter, but that is interesting. We'll see. I mean, look, you know, Michael Cohen was a great guy until he turned on Trump. Now he's a traitor and he's a convicted liar, according to the president. We now learned that Paul Manafort leaked polling data to somebody who was linked to Russian intelligence. I mean, the things we're learning about this gang of operatives is just startling. And I think, but about the Rudy thing, I think it was really Rudy being Rudy. But
yep.
You know what I'm interested in? What is a veteran political journalist?
I'm having a hard time with veteran, Ken. I'll be honest with you. I'm having a hard time saying veteran.
How about what is that?
Seasoned?
I'm a veterinarian? Seasoned? Old? No, what are you saying?
I don't know. That's what the card says. That's what the card. You don't like? What's the word you would like? Seasoned? Experienced?
Charming?
Charming. There you go.
Charming, yeah.
Charming,
yeah.
Witty? Witty. Oh, God. Witty.
Yeah.
Witty. Charming
Calling
and witty political.
Thank you. Yeah.
I want to change the card. Ken Rudin, charming and witty political journalist
and host of
Ken Rudin's political podcast. You know, we have a podcast.
Which you could find at krpoliticaljunkie.com, by the way.
Okay. All right.
Just saying.
We have a podcast here we started a few months ago, back in March, actually, called Snollygoster. Do you know what a Snollygoster is?
He's the governor of Wyoming.
It's a 19th century term, and it means a shrewd politician who puts ambition over principle. So we were looking for a unique name.
We don't have much of those, do we?
No. You know how I found the name? I just Googled odd political terms, and that came up first. So
that's a great name. I love it.
Anyway, we'll have to get you on sometime. Maybe we'll get you on that podcast at some point. We just focus on Ohio politics,
and you know how to introduce me, right?
Witty, charming political journalist Ken Rudin.
Yep.
And host of the always charming and witty political junkie.
Yep. That's it.
Not to change gears completely, but foreign policy, still decisions to move troops out of Syria. We had a suicide bombing this week. You know, political implications of that have put Republicans especially in a tough spot there. They're generally pro-military, want to side with the generals, but here's Trump going against what the generals recommend and want to pull troops out of Syria in particular.
And the Republicans are furious about that. Certainly Lindsey Graham is. I mean, Lindsey Graham, who has gone from a Trump critic to a Trump backer, but he still says that, look, you know, the fact that, how do you say that ISIS is defeated when they have these attacks that killed four Americans yesterday? So, and that's why Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, resigned. Nobody feels that ISIS is defeated. Nobody feels that a quick pullout. Look, who was the only person, or the first person, who praised Trump for announcing that decision? It was Vladimir Putin. It was.
Yeah.
I'm not making this stuff up. So obviously the Pentagon is against it. Many Republicans in the Senate are against it. And I just wonder if that tragic attack by ISIS in the last day or so might change the president's mind about it. But we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to have – he kept going back and forth on it in his own mind. I didn't want an immediate pullout. I wanted a, you know, quick pullout. But he first said 30 days. But he did promise it during the campaign. He wanted to get out of the wars in the Middle East. And it's just – it's hard to do, as we have seen, especially with Afghanistan and the length of time we have been there. And
what have we accomplished?
Yes, with little
what
results.
What have we accomplished except
– Yeah. Charming and witty political journalist Ken Rudin.
Yep. That's correct.
Thank you very much for joining us. It's a quick hour, always is, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Again, you can check out his podcast, Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. I assume you can get it on iTunes and Spotify and all that good stuff, Ken.
Yep.
And then the website again is?
krpoliticaljunkie.com.
What is KR? Oh, I got it. KR.
Carl Rove. It's just for Carl Rove.
Yes, it could be. Anyway, Ken Rudin, always a pleasure to talk to you here on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you so much, Mike.
All right, enjoy the snow. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, streaming on the web at WOSU.org.